ويغفر الله أكبر. الله أكبر الله أكبر. لا إله إلا الله.
In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, the Creator and the Sustainer of the Universe, peace and blessings upon His servant and messenger Muhammad forever. Amin. I bear witness that there is no God worthy of worship except the one true God, and I bear witness that Muhammad is the messenger and servant of God. I greet you, as is my fashion, with the universal greetings of peace, a greeting that has been used by all of the prophets from Abraham through the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon them all. Assalamu alaikum, which means peace be unto you. Today we have our 19th program in our series dealing with the social system of Islam. We'll be looking at Muslim women in history. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid, and I have joining me on the program, as usual, Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Brother Jamal, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
I wonder if perhaps is also our fashion if I could just have you very quickly summarize the main points we touched on in last week's program.
Certainly. First of all, the first part was a continuation of our discussion of Muslim women in the so-called public affairs, what we call today political life. And we used the example of what happened during the days of Umar, the second caliph after the Prophet, who was corrected by a woman in the masjid, and we made the analogy between that and political activities taking place today. And then we went on to discuss the issue as to whether Islam sanctions a Muslim woman being in a position of leadership and responsibility. Mm-hmm. And we quoted the saying of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, kullukum ra'in, that each one of you is leader, which included also women as well. And we indicated that the role even of a woman who is not employed at home as a mother and as a wife is a role which carries importance, responsibility and direction of others if she has children, and that's what leadership is all about. Mm-hmm. But specifically if we mean by public office or leadership in a sense of position of sensitivity or importance or prominence in the society, we have indicated that as a basic rule there is no clear-cut prohibition in Islamic law. The only thing that was excluded by a particular text was the headship of the state, which appears not in the Quran, even it appears in the word of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And we discussed some of the possible reasons for this particular restriction on the basis of the totality of the framework of Islam and the nature of the role of the Muslim caliph leading prayers even, and we talked about how this is different from other frameworks. But as far as anything beyond the headship of the state, we indicated that there is nothing conclusive about restricting a Muslim woman from mm-hmm. occupying any other position. We indicated that some jurists, the majority, feel that a woman serving as a judge should be analogous to serving as a head of state. But we indicated again that a great scholar like At-Tabari says that this analogy is not correct, it's just a matter of interpretation. Abu Hanifa took a middle ground between both opinions, but there's nothing conclusive about it. Finally, we touched on the question of accepting the witness of a Muslim woman and why, particularly in financial dealings or financial contracts, as indicated in a verse in the Quran in chapter 2, that's verse 282, it indicated that the witnesses should be either two men or one man and two women. And we indicated again that the verse itself explained the reason that on the whole, most women would not be as involved in the details of financial dealings, and as such, as the verse says, if one of the women forgets or does not pay as much attention to what was going on, the other one perhaps can step in and correct her or help her to remember properly what went on. So basically we say that it has nothing to do with the status, but rather the approach of establishing justice and making sure before ruling is made that there's all kind of precautions about the accuracy of the event.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, on this topic of the Muslim woman as a witness, before we go on and get into the topic for today. We mentioned that she was able to be a witness in financial dealings and
so on.
Is it accepted, permissible for a Muslim woman to become a witness in matters other than those dealing with financial matters?
Well, we find many scholars, for example, like Abu Hanifa and Ibn al-Qayyim, hold the view that a woman's witness is accepted in all areas, excluding criminal law, the area, you know, giving witness on a crime. And some jurists try to explain that in a sense that, you know, the site of the crime, which might involve bloodshed, might be too much of a shock for most women. It could be a shock for men too, but it might be a shock for most women who are emotional by nature, which might again result in inaccurate perception of exactly what went on, which might affect life or death in terms of the accused. But even then, this is not a universal view that is held by all Muslim jurists. We find that other famous Muslim jurists like Az-Zuhri and Al-Awza'i, as quoted, for example, in a very important reference called Criminal Law in Islam, in Arabic, At-Tashri' al-Jinai fi al-Islam, authored by Abdul Qadir Auda in the second volume, particularly page 315, in which he quotes this, or referred to this jurist, as indicating or holding the view that the witness of a woman is to be accepted in any matter or any dispute, including the issue of criminal law. So there's a difference of opinion on that. And like I said earlier, it's just a matter of interpretation. There's nothing conclusive in the Quran or the words of the Prophet that restrict a Muslim woman from that particular activity. But insofar as whether that witness that is requiring one man and two women or two men extends or applies to other areas other than criminal law, again, it is a matter of interpretation.
Other than financial, you mean?
Other than financial, that's right. It is a matter of interpretation. There's nothing conclusive really about it, even though the majority of jurists extend that to apply to other areas beyond financial dealings. They say the same rule, that you have to have two men or one man or two women. But there are some questionable or questions pertaining to the methodology of that analogy. And in my humble understanding, this analogy suffers from some weaknesses in the basis of the Quran, on the basis of prophetic tradition, and on the basis of the overall spirit of Islamic law. Let me try to give the evidence that I feel should be looked into carefully. In the Quran, we find that there are at least seven places where the witness, and that is witness in dealings or disputes, is mentioned. There are the word witness or shahid appears also in the context of other things. But in terms of actual disputes, there are at least seven verses in the Quran. I check that in the concordance.
Mm-hmm.
In one of them, one of the seven only, there is this requirement that the witnesses should be either two men or one man and two women. And this is the verse we quoted in the previous program, that's chapter 2, verse 282. That's the only exclusion or the only specification of the sex of the witnesses in financial dealings. In a second, in another verse, that is in the chapter 24, verses 6 to 9, we find that the witness of a man is exactly equated with the witness of a woman.
Mm-hmm.
This we quoted before in a previous program, that is the case when one spouse, a husband or wife, accuse his spouse or her spouse of committing adultery.
Mm-hmm.
In which case, the denial is just as good as the accusation. In other words, the witness of a man is exactly equated with the witness of a woman.
Mm-hmm.
In the other five verses, which I did check, we find that the Quran does not specify whether those witnesses should be men or women or what kind of combinations. So there is no conclusive evidence. The verses for reference is chapter 4, verse 15, chapter 5, verse 109, chapter 24, verse 4, chapter 24, verse 13, and chapter 65, verse 2. In all of these five verses, which talk about witness in dispute, there is no specification of the sex of the witness. I mentioned also that this analogy or requiring two women witness for one man seem to contradict or seem not to be consistent, at least, with prophetic tradition. How, for example, in the several references or collections of prophetic sayings in Muslim, Abu Dawood, and Nasa'i, and Tirmidhi, it was reported that Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, in some dispute, decided on the dispute by one statement under oath and one witness, without specifying the sex of that witness, which leaves the possibility that it might have been either a man or a woman. And furthermore, we find in other numerous saying of the Prophet, particularly in Abu Dawood and At-Tirmidhi, that Prophet Muhammad, for example, said that he did or was reported to have rejected the witness of a person who is untrustworthy, a person who is jealous of somebody else against whom he's making witness, and a person who is subordinate to other, where there is fear that he might be just doing that to please his boss. In all of those incidents, he mentioned the both male and female gender, the untrustworthy man, untrustworthy woman. So in each of them he repeated that, which again showed some kind of similarity or analogy. And finally, in my humble understanding, it seemed to contradict also the spirit of Islamic law, because according to the Quran, to give a witness is not only just a right or privilege, it is a duty. For example, we find in chapter 2, verse 282 in the Quran, it says that people who are invited to give witness should not abstain. It is a duty that they should give witness. In the same chapter, in the following verse, it says that concealing truth or concealing witness mm-hmm. is a sin. It's wrong. One should not conceal the witness. In chapter 65, in verse 2, it says that witness is something that one should do for the sake of God. Well, from all of this, it shows that it is a duty. Now the question is this. Now suppose that there is an incident, and the only witnesses for that were either one man and one woman, or even two women. Would it be conceivable under the spirit of Islamic law to stick to technicalities and say, no, these are two women, there must be another man, resulting in the loss of the rights of others and lack of establishment of justice? So if we look at it then in terms of all of these references, we find that the requirement of two women witness for one man, and other than what the Quran specified in one single verse, that is in financial dealing, does not seem to have a very solid ground, even though the majority of jurists have agreed to that. But luckily there have been some other jurists who had more insightful thought about this whole issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, now that moving into today's discussion of Muslim women in Islamic history, I wonder if perhaps we could touch on the applied side of this topic, and I'd like to ask you if there are specific examples of prominent Muslim women in Islamic history. Perhaps we could begin with looking at women who've been prominent in matters of faith.
Well, one of the greatest tributes that Islam made to pious Muslim women is that the very first person who embraced Islam after Prophet Muhammad was given the mission or was commanded was not a man, was a woman.
Yes.
His wife, Khadija. According to Islamic history, when he was contemplating in the cave of Hira, that is, even before he received the command, he used to go sometimes as long as 1 month during the month of Ramadan in a cave outside of Mecca, just on the top of the mountain, alone, contemplating, meditating, trying to discover the truth or to seek God's guidance to help him discover the truth. Even before he received that first revelation, his wife did not object, as you know how many wives would yes. like their husbands to be away for a month. She did not stop him or try to make an obstacle in his way. Many times even she visited him and provided him with supplies. But when the first revelation came to him, he was alone. He came down very scared because he didn't know what that person claiming to be Angel Gabriel is. He thought that it could be an evil spirit or something.
Mm-hmm.
He was trembling and he was in a very fearful state of what happened to him. He ran away to his home. Instead of Khadija, his wife, telling him that, you know, what happened to you and all that, and try to accuse him of imagining things, she immediately comforted him. When he said, could that be an evil spirit that came to me in the cave? She said, no. And one of her beautiful I should say, comforting words were something like this. He said, by the name of God, God will never let you down. After all, you are kind to your relatives. You help those who are weak. You are charitable to those who are in need. You speak the truth. You are hospitable to your guests. And you comfort those who suffer. In other words, concluding from his character and behavior that what happened to him can never be an evil spirit, God will not let you down. See, when the person comes in this state of tension and finding these comforting words from his beloved one, and the effect it would have on him to persevere and to carry his responsibility. The belief in Khadija, or her honor of being the very first Muslim, the very first person to accept Islam as completed through Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was not just a matter of faith or belief in the heart. Indeed, she shared with him all his suffering and difficulties and sacrifices again in his struggle against all evil and falsehood and the persecution of his own people, his own relatives even. And whenever he faced all these difficulties outside of his home and came back home, he found the kind heart, the support, the comforting words, the encouragement from his wife Khadija. So her role was quite crucial in the carrying out of his responsibility. And even when the going became very tough, and the pagans at that time put the Muslims into what you might call today a siege, really, virtually a siege, boycotting them, not selling them any food, and Muslims were almost like in a siege in a particular place in Mecca, Khadija was very rich and should have just got out of it. But she joined her husband and other Muslims, suffered hunger, thirst, and deprivation, despite the fact that she was rich and she was not used to this kind of suffering. But that shows again that she was really living with her heart, mind, and physical existence with the suffering and sacrifice of the Prophet, peace be upon him.
Was there any recognition of Khadija's faith, her strong faith?
Well, suffice to say that recognition, basically, or the highest of recognition, came from God himself. It was narrated in Bukhari, a collection of prophetic tradition, that one time Angel Gabriel came to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and he said to him, in a few minutes, here is Khadija. She's coming to you, bringing you some food in a container, a pot. When she comes to you, convey to her greetings of peace from God and from me. Greetings of peace from God, special greeting sent to her. Mm-hmm. And then he said, tell her also, or give her the glad tiding, that God has prepared a house for her, for Khadija, in paradise, which is made of pearl, precious stone. Wherein, that is, inside that house, there is neither noise nor fatigue or suffering. This is an interesting description of her abode in paradise, because, as some scholars explain, a house wherein there is no noise. And they say that Khadija, in terms of her own character in dealing with her husband, the Prophet, she never raised her voice on him. And she suffered the noise made by the unbelievers. So as such, God is rewarding her now comfort away from this noise. Mm-hmm. Secondly, that this house, in that house, there is no fatigue or suffering. Because again, she never caused any fatigue or suffering to the Prophet, but was nothing or no more than a very sincere and comforting spouse to the Prophet, peace be upon him.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, how we just said the tremendous amount of sacrifice that Khadija made in terms of supporting Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him. How about recognition of this sacrifice on the part of Prophet Muhammad himself? Did he say anything about her?
He said and did even. First of all, during their marital life, the amount of love and affection that Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, showed towards his wife Khadija was exemplary. Suffice to say that when they got married, Prophet Muhammad was 25 years old. Khadija was 40 years old. That is 15 years older than he was. He lived with her as his only wife for a period of 25 years. That is basic active life, really, from the age of 25 to the age of 50. And when she died, she was 65, he was 50. And that marriage proved to be, despite of this difference in age, A very happy, very successful marriage, very stable marriage, because it was built upon mutual appreciation of human qualities rather than other flashy things in their lives. In some of his sayings, when he talks about women who achieved perfection, in one hadith or one saying, he mentioned Asiya, the wife of Pharaoh, Mary, the mother of Jesus, and Khadija, his own wife. In one, another version, he mentioned also Fatima, his daughter. But it is quite interesting in the version that he mentioned three very perfect women, as humanly as possible, of course. Absolute perfection pertains to God. That the choice of these particular three women. And if you look carefully into these women, you find that they played very significant role in the life of three major prophets, three major religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam.
Yes.
Asiya, the wife of the Pharaoh, acted as the foster mother of Moses. There's one. Mary, the mother of Jesus, peace be upon him, played a very crucial role in upbringing her child, Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him. Mm-hmm. That's the second. Mm-hmm. Khadija played a very important role in the life of her husband, the last prophet, Muhammad, peace be upon them all. So it's really an interesting mention that shows a great deal of appreciation. In fact, that appreciation was so much repeated by him. That is, even after her death, he was very faithful to her memory, always praising her. Indeed, he used to even be generous to her own relatives and friends. Sometimes when he slaughters an animal, for example, like a sheep or something, he sent piece of the meat or part of the meat to such and such lady. Why? Because she was a friend. She used to visit us when Khadija was alive.
Yes.
That praise was so continuous that his wife Aisha one time got a little jealous, as a human being and a woman, of course. And she once told him, "You keep mentioning that old lady. Didn't God replace that old lady with one who is better than her?" Referring to herself. And the Prophet got angry and says, "No, God did not replace her with someone who is better than her. After all, she accepted Islam when people disbelieved. She believed in me and she was faithful to me when other people disbelieved and rejected me. She supported me with her property and made it under my disposal and the disposal of Islamic faith when other people withheld their financial support." And then he added, "And God gave me all my children," or he meant almost all my children, "through her." And in fact, he was referring to the fact that only one child was born to a wife other than Khadija. That is Ibrahim, who was born to Mary, the Egyptian girl. But other than that, all his children was born from that first wife, Khadija. Who, as I indicated before, she was his only wife for 25 years.
Yes.
Two boys and four girls. The two boys were Al-Qasim and Abdullah. Abdullah was also given the title of At-Tayyib and At-Tahir. And the four girls, Ruqayya, Zainab, Umm Kulthum, and the youngest one, Fatima, who is another very prominent woman in Islamic history.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, so far we've talked about prominent Muslim women whose husbands have also been believers in Islam. Are there examples in Islamic history where there were prominent women whose faith was independent of that of her husband?
Yes, they were independent, both of their husband, their fathers, and their brothers. And that showed, again, that they had their independent personality, especially in the matter of faith.
Yes.
Let me give you just three examples. All three examples, by the way, appear in a variety of references. And most of these incidents I reported, in addition to appearing in the books of hadith or prophetic tradition, there are two other very good references. One is called Tabaqat ibn Sa'd. And the other one is called Al-Isaba fi Tamiz al-Sahaba. In the case of a husband, for example, that we find that the daughter of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, Zainab, was a believer. She became Muslim, but her husband, Al-As ibn Wa'il, Al-As ibn Rabi', was not a believer. And she didn't care, and actually she was separated from him because it wasn't permissible for her to live with him. We find that Umm Habiba, the daughter of Abu Sufyan, became Muslim while her father was not a believer. And she treated him, actually, in a way that showed that the bonds of faith were more important in her mind than the blood relationship. We find the example of Fatima, the daughter of Al-Khattab, who was a sister of Umar ibn Al-Khattab,
yes,
who later on became a Muslim, became a very good Muslim in fact, and became the second caliph after the Prophet. But before he became believer, he once went to his sister's house and found her reciting the Quran, the scriptures. So he was very angry because he was an unbeliever at that time, and he beat her up, and when he saw the blood in her face, he felt ashamed of himself. And then he asked to read the Quran, and his heart was touched and he became a believer. But that showed again that despite of the toughness of her brother and his disbelief at that time, she became Muslim. So there are lots of examples. There are examples of Muslim women who even migrated, leaving behind their families to protect their faith, like Umm Kulthum, for example, the daughter of Uqba. After the Hudaybiyah treaty, she migrated to Medina, leaving behind her own folks. So they were quite independent in that. Yeah.
Right. Well, maybe we look at another aspect of involvement of Muslim women in the early community, and that is in the area of the struggles of the early Muslim community, the tough times they had in terms of establishing Islam. Are there any record of the Muslim women being subjected to torture and other kinds of suffering?
There is an honorable record, and in fact, that's where Muslim women had scored the first also. As indicated before, Khadija was the first one to become a Muslim.
Yes.
The first one to sacrifice her own life for the sake of Islam was a woman also. That's an interesting, turn of events. That was Sumayya, the mother of Ammar ibn Yasir, one of the great and prominent companions of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. When they became Muslims in the early period in Mecca, when Muslims were persecuted, she, her husband, and her son were severely tortured by the pagans, especially by a man by the name of Abu Jahl. And at one point he got so frustrated because of her perseverance and patience under all these forms of torture that he stabbed her in her lower abdomen with his spear, and she died. She became the first martyr for the sake of her faith. There are other examples of women who were tortured and punished also by Abu Jahl and similar ignorant people like him, to the point that her sight was lost. When her sight was lost, they taunted her, the unbeliever, they taunted her. They said, "All right, it is our idols who caused the loss of your sight." And she responded in faith that they are lying because these idols can do no good nor harm. And it was reported historically that God restored her sight to her. But even those women who were not directly tortured, suffice that they saw their beloved ones, their fathers, their children, their husbands, being tortured, their brothers tortured before their own eyes, but they never cracked, and they always persevered and provided comfort and encouragement for their faithful relatives. Indeed, some of them even were given very dangerous assignments or accepted assignments which put their lives in jeopardy.
In the minute or so that we have left remaining, could you perhaps give us a very quick illustration of this exposure to danger?
Well, when Prophet Muhammad and his companion Abu Bakr were migrating from Mecca to Medina, the pagans were very angry and they were really demanding his head, life or dead. So they made big and generous reward for anyone who can kill him. And the Prophet Muhammad and Abu Bakr went to a cave called Thawr, the cave of Thawr, south of Medina, south of Mecca, before he continued his journey, just to evade the pursuers. And the pagans, led by Abu Jahl, went to the house of Abu Bakr. So his daughter Asma came out. They asked, "Where is your father?" She said, "I don't know." Of course, she knew. They slapped her on her face to the point that her earring, came out. But she still never cracked or told. In fact, she carried the very dangerous responsibility of carrying food supplies secretly and the news, the latest news about what is going on, to Abu Bakr and the Prophet while they were hiding in the cave. This was a very dangerous thing. If she were caught,
yes,
she could have probably paid her lives for that. Fatima, the daughter of the Prophet, used to defend him so much when he was attacked by others. It was narrated that one time he was doing his prayer, so somebody brought intestines of a slaughtered camel and put it over his head. Fatima rushed there, despite of the danger, to clean that from the back of her father, the Prophet. There are numerous examples of exposure to danger on the part of Muslim women.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've exhausted our time for today. We want to thank you for watching our program. Join us next week when we'll continue our series on the social system of Islam. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.